Sometimes after a week of confusing or frightening news, it can feel doubly important to stop and reassess where you are in the world, what anchors you, what day-to-day things matter, and what don't. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week on the show, we've got the stories of your personal economies, the loans that changed your paths, and stories about the economy of terrorism, finding it, fighting it, plus some important everyday stuff, like why your office life is so weird. As always, our stories start with you, so come talk to us at marketplaceweekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Last week on the show, we asked you to think about a loan that's played a big role in your life, good or bad, and our voicemail filled up quickly. We're starting this conversation with Michael Douglas Stuckey. He's 22 and lives in Middleton, Ohio. He heard us on member station KBSX. He needed a car to get to his new job and borrowed $2,500 from his brother. He's paid it off, but here's the catch.
The main disadvantage is that fact that I can't report it to a credit agency. As such, I don't really get any credit that I can use towards a bigger loan for like a house or rental or stuff like that.
A lot of people are nervous about getting a loan from a family member or somebody else they're close to. What's your relationship like with your brother? And did it change at all because of the loan?
He didn't really change at all, no. He actually, and this is kind of ironic because he's my younger brother, he actually got a job welding much earlier than I was able to get a job. Like, I had been searching for a job and couldn't find anything. And so I think in this aspect, at least, he was trying to help out and stuff because he thought I did need a job. I needed a way to get to that job.
Were there things that you, you know, did for your brother or thought about, you know, non-monetary things because of this?
I helped him out at a few things. I do tech support calls. I've been helping him out with he recently purchased a mobile device. And so I've been helping him out with that, helping him get that sorted out, help him learn the ins and outs of how to use it. Like, I've helped out in that way. It's one of the things that I kind of hold dear to my heart is that we need to help each other out as a family, especially when you're still all living under the same roof.
Kelly Russell is 31 and was also listening to KBSX in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Idaho. Thanks for listening. Russell works in marketing, and her student loans helped her get through school, but they still hang over her.
What if I get fired, or what if I get laid off again? And so it's had two, it's like a double-edged sword to it.
You just said, what if I get laid off again? Did that happen to you once?
Yes, I actually got laid off twice in 2009. So it made it very real that I had to get under this whole budget thing and taking care of these student loans and paying them down. I had to get it under control.
I've talked to a lot of people for this show in different times who just like detest their student lender. They're either the like envelope causes some reaction of fear, or there's the phone call, or you know, any of that stuff. You don't sound that way.
There is a lot that has been positive out of these loans. However, I would never do it again.
Really?
Really. I think I would definitely, if I had the wisdom and the understanding that I have today, I would have gone a different route. I would have gone to a different school possibly or a different opportunity somewhere else. But I think everything happens for a reason too, and I think I was supposed to be where I was, and for some reason, this was what got me there.
How much debt do you have left?
Around $50,000 left.
Wow, what'd you start with?
I started actually with about $72,000.
Oh, so you've made some real progress.
I've made a little bit of progress. I wish I could have made more, but I had to work my way really up again and the pay scale, and it has taken a little while to get back to there, so but now it's like fifth gear. I'm going for it, and I'm getting them paid off.
Ryan Heisinger comes to us from WVGR in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he works at a boys and girls club. He's 27. He also reached out to us about student loans, $75,000 in them. Loans, he says, he really didn't understand when he took them out as an 18-year-old.
I didn't really fully understand what it meant to sign that piece of paper and to agree to the terms of that loan when I went to college, because I was just 18 and I had not really understood that concept of how much money that really was.
When you think about where you are now, was it worth it?
Was it worth it? Yeah. So that's a murky question. I don't think that I would ever say, no, it wasn't worth it, because college is important. It's opened doors for me. But at the time, I got my teaching degree. I went to college and they said, yeah, hey, you're going to get your degree. You're going to go work in the schools in our city, and we're going to give you your degree at the end of 4 years, and then you'll have a job. And that's not exactly the way that happened. So do I regret it? Would I say don't do it? No, I wouldn't say that. But I would say really look at your options. Decide if college is right for you, because the cost is so high that you'll be paying it off for the next 30 years of your life.
In our next conversation, we want to know, do you think you get paid enough for what you actually do? I mean, beyond your job description. And if not, why not? Tell us by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org. Chat with me on Marketplace's Facebook page or call 1-800-648-5114. Now we're going to make a couple of smart people go on the record with topics in the news that they are long or short, betting on or against, much in the way that stock pickers make bets on different equities. And this week, to play the long-short game, we've got Marketplace's Kimberly Adams and Jillian White from The Atlantic. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Jillian, I want to start with you. What are your longs for us this week? What are you long?
I'm long a couple things. The first one is diversity on TV. And this has been a pretty hot issue lately, largely because of Aziz Ansari and Master of None. But I think it's a conversation that we need to be having kind of nonstop. There are a couple of really awesome examples. Jane the Virgin is another one. Empire is kind of one. But I think it's pretty awesome that so many different people can look at TV now and see awesome representations of themselves.
I love that. I'm totally long on that, too.
Well, all right, Kimberly. So let's get your long for this week.
I am long on negative online reviews, which I take probably a sick pleasure in publishing, because the Senate Commerce Committee just moved forward legislation this week on the Consumer Review Freedom Act. So basically, a lot of companies, including some doctors and dentists and things, have been putting these clauses in their contracts or before they see you, saying you can't post negative online reviews about them or they'll sue you. And so there's legislation working its way through Congress saying that's not cool. I mean, if we couldn't have online negative reviews, we'd get this sort of pie in the sky image of perfect retailers and doctors. Alternatively, yeah, you're going to have these Black Friday deals for laser hair removal as long as you promise that you can't say anything negative about the companies. And finally, if you weren't allowed to post any negative reviews, if you found a roach in your Thanksgiving turkey, you might not be able to say anything about it.
Ugh. Jillian, I'm going to let you hop in. You had another long for us. What was that?
Yeah, I have another long, which is conversations about family leave. So Spotify recently said that they are going to offer 6 months of leave to their employees in the U.S., which is kind of similar to what they do in Sweden, where people generally have longer family leave. And I think this is awesome. And again, this is something we have been talking about for a long time, but need to be talking about more. So one of the conversations that a lot of people are having right now is about the piece by Amber Scora, who unfortunately lost her infant child on his first day of daycare. It was absolutely gut-wrenching. If you haven't read it, you should definitely check it out. But I think the idea that people have to make a choice between caring a ton about their job and their profession and caring about their family, be it a baby, be it a sick relative, being it an elderly parent, is absolutely absurd. And I think the more companies that we have and the more conversations that we have about family leave policies and what makes sense and what's helpful and what helps both individuals and workers and companies overall, I think the longer we talk about it, the better it'll get.
Well, I have a question here because we've seen companies, certainly a lot of tech companies, on the forefront with some of these policies. But Kimberly, you know, you cover politics in D.C. It feels to me like we do not have that conversation on a national level in the government. Really, local governments are having it, but not on the federal level.
It's not in terms of, you know, legislation or policies coming through, but there is some evidence that there are sort of these trickle down effects from the tech industry. So I did some interviews a month or two ago with somebody, a law firm that was implementing these same sorts of family leave because they said, look, we do a lot of work in the tech field and all of our lawyers are being snatched up by these tech firms because we don't offer the same family leave. And so
oh my
as there's
God,
more
that's fascinating.
So as there's more and more crossover between the people who are in the tech industry and other fields, we are, I think, going to see these sorts of policies appear elsewhere.
All right, Jillian, throw out your short for me.
My short is online betting and fantasy sports. I do not want to hear any more about it. I understand that it's a big deal. I understand there is a ton of money in it, which is also stressful for me. But people are largely losing money on this. Yeah, it's just ongoing and I get it, but I really don't want to talk about it anymore. I also don't want to think about the fact that some people are winning or losing six-figure sums on a fantasy sports team online.
You know we're getting letters about this, right? Absolutely, I guarantee it.
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback on that. Anybody whose entire company is built upon a loophole in legislation, I'm going to say short.
You've got a short for us that's also, I guess we should say, in the geopolitical world.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a downer. I am short on Europe's open borders. I mean, after the Paris attacks, countries like France and Germany are reinstituting tougher, more stringent border checks. And these are countries that are all part of the Schengen zone that's supposed to allow for the open movement of goods and people, which is why the migrant crisis or the refugee crisis in Europe has spread so quickly.
Yeah.
And now it just looks like this is really under threat with lots and lots of political leaders across Europe saying this just isn't working anymore.
Kimberly Adams and Jillian White, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Here are a few sobering numbers about how ISIS funds its operations. The U.S. Treasury estimates that ISIS looted between $500 million and $1 billion from U.S. banks last year. And earlier this year, the group was making about $40 million a month from the sale of oil. So, yeah, following the money seems like a good way to disrupt them. Except doing that in 2015 is a lot more complicated than it used to be, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Juan Zarate started work at the Treasury Department the summer before 9/11. After the attacks, he was one of the people trying to figure out how to follow the money in the fight against terrorism. He helped set up the Treasury's Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence.
When you get to your desk in the morning, what do you do? How do you do this?
Well, to follow the money, what you need in front of you is data. You need information.
Zarate's now with a private advisory firm, the Financial Integrity Network. He says with groups like Al-Qaeda, we got used to using financial tools and sanctions from afar to shut terrorists out of the global financial system. Now, it's harder.
That grows more difficult when these groups are running local economies and using local resources to their benefit. You can't push a button magically in New York or London or Washington to constrict their resources.
ISIS makes money from the territory it controls, from taxing goods that cross its border to selling oil. So the approach has to change.
The terrorist financing of 2015 requires on-the-ground intelligence gathering in environments that we do not control, requires dislodgement of groups from resources and populations that they lord over and profit from. And it really becomes a very much a physical effort.
He says investigators still look for places where terrorists connect to the traditional financial system because he thinks they can't fully operate outside of it. But instead of big global banks, it might be a smaller financial institution in Mosul, which ISIS controls, or a broker for oil or looted antiquities. Zarate says tracing these connections is one challenge. Containing them is another.
And I'm not sure that we've figured that out yet because these are groups that have grown quite innovative.
It's a whole different approach than looking at bank transfers, wire transfers.
Louise Shelley is the director of the Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center at George Mason University.
We need to increasingly focus on the relationship of crime and terrorism so that we don't see these as two separate problems.
She says these days there isn't much terrorism that doesn't involve some other crime. It's become a familiar pattern.
For example, one of the terrorists who attacked Charlie Hebdo was trading in counterfeit sneakers. The terrorist who attacked on the Thalys train between Brussels and Paris, he was a small-scale drug trafficker.
Shelley says terrorism investigators need to work better with those focusing on illegal trade or drugs or human trafficking. So yeah, you're still following money transfers, but also mapping the network of counterfeit sneaker suppliers.
And you begin to see the convergence of these activities because the terrorists are generally functioning like diversified business people.
Shelley says both the White House and the UN have called for prioritizing the links between crime and terrorism. She thinks New York and LA are already doing this well, but nationally and internationally?
I don't think we're doing this well enough on the national level or in many other cities where this needs to be done.
It is an ongoing issue.
Ray Kelly is the former commissioner of the NYPD, now vice chairman of K2 Intelligence.
But you have to stress that the amount of money needed for a terrorist event is sometimes shockingly small.
So following the money is a tool, not the tool, says Matthew Levitt with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Sad fact is that there are lots and lots of ways to make, raise, move, access, launder money. Sometimes people assume that following the money will be a panacea. And it's powerful, yes, but it's no panacea.
He says it's extremely unlikely that we could completely shut down funding for a given group or bankrupt them completely.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. He's also bringing us exclusive content from Marketplace's new podcast, Codebreaker. So, Ben, this week, you're exploring the dark web.
Yes, that's right, Lizzie.
What is that?
The dark web is part of this larger piece of the internet called the deep web, with a lot of things that are just not searchable. Sometimes they're banking networks and other things like that that you wouldn't find if you search them in Google. The dark web is this part of the web where a lot of illegal things happen, where sometimes weapons are being sold, sometimes illegal drugs are being sold, and you need actually real special anonymizing tools to access and use the dark web effectively. The most famous case, Lizzie, is probably Silk Road, which you have probably heard of. Ross Ulbricht, the guy who ran that for several years as it became really popular, has been given a life sentence earlier this year for that. But ever since the Silk Road was closed by law enforcement, the dark web has really only evolved and grown to include more dark web markets and things like that. And now people are even using parts of the dark web to, in some cases, buy life-saving legal drugs. I talked to a guy who did this. His name is Ross Whitaker. A while back, his wife got diagnosed with severe asthma.
I mean, to start off, she has two inhalers that she has to use every day. One is a maintenance inhaler, which she uses two times a day. And then she also has another inhaler. It's called a rescue inhaler. And she has trouble breathing. That's when the rescue inhaler comes in.
But they're not cheap.
No, they're not cheap.
So they're pretty expensive, Lizzie, and she needs this stuff to really keep her alive on a daily basis and in the case of emergencies.
So how much money are we talking about?
For Ross, the monthly cost was about $350 that her insurance at the time that he did this did not cover.
I mean, she literally tried to get a prescription for her inhaler filled, and the pharmacy said it's going to be $300. There was no way. We couldn't afford that at the time. You know, we could sit down and look at our budget and say, well, you know, we could not pay for our electricity and water this month, and we could get your inhaler, you know, but that's not really an option either.
So they were trying to figure out some way to pay. Ross had been looking separately into the idea of the dark web. He was just sort of curious about it.
I almost kind of like informally study them in a way. I have a fascination with them. And because of that, I had talked to her about it. These are the sorts of things that you can purchase on these markets.
Uh-huh.
And it's not just illegal drugs and whatever else, but it's also, you know, blood pressure medicine and, you know, Viagra, whatever. You know, there's all kinds of things on there. One night, kind of out of nowhere, she said, "Do you think we could get an inhaler from one of those darknet markets?" And I said, you know, I don't know, but I'll look.
So you looked?
I did look, and I found an inhaler, and I was able to find a vendor that sold, you know, the exact maintenance inhaler that she needed, you know, same brand, same dosage and all that, and it was significantly cheaper.
How much cheaper are we talking?
It was $30 with international shipping.
10%.
Yeah.
Of the cost.
Right.
So that's really interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Lizzie, the drugs were coming from India, and they often come in the mail in this kind of nondescript box. You know, they look kind of weird, but that's part of the process. The sellers often disguise what they are sending to make sure you don't get in trouble. And I asked Ross if he and his wife were suspicious of the quality.
Jackie's a very daring woman, I guess. I mean, she just used it. Once we realized that it was identical to the one she already had, and she just went for it, and it was fine.
So I asked him about the reputation of the dark web as an illegal drug market. Does he feel like a criminal?
There's more to it than that. I definitely think that they're positive for both people that are using illegal drugs and people like me and my wife who just needed to be able to afford a medication that Jackie needed to continue living.
This is an incredible story, but it also makes me wonder, what is the legality of doing what they were doing?
Yeah, so I asked Ross a little bit about this too, and he said that as near as he can tell, what he did was technically illegal that he did this. Now, he would call this lucky. They have better employment now. When they were trying to buy these drugs, that was actually under, they live in Kentucky, that was actually under the exchange plan in Kentucky, and they couldn't get the drugs that they needed. So he said that now they're able to do this, and so they've stopped buying this stuff on the dark web. But it's, I don't know, it's just an interesting thing, Lizzie, that people are like finding this stuff on the dark web and they're not necessarily looking to be criminal, right? But sometimes they're finding stuff that they can't find or afford otherwise.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and Marketplace's new Codebreaker podcast, which you can get on iTunes and anywhere else you get your podcasts. His dark web episode comes out this week. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Every week on the show, we're digging into one economic story that comes from you, our listeners. It's part of a project we call Local Money, where you tell us what's going on where you live. This week, David Pessis went to our website to tell us about the library in Gloversville, New York, northwest of Albany. It's more than 100 years old and was once a crown jewel of a very prosperous town. Gloversville's fortunes have declined, and so have the library's. Now there's a campaign to raise several million dollars to restore it. We reached out to Fulton County, New York historian Samantha Hall Palladino. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Can you describe this library for me? What does it look like?
It's a very large building. It was built in the Beaux-Arts style, which if you've ever been to Grand Central Station or the New York Public Library, it's a similar style to that. Big arches, columns, very regal looking building.
And I gather it was built initially with a $50,000 grant from, what, Andrew Carnegie?
That's correct. The Carnegie grant was originally for $50,000, and there were a couple of stipulations that came with his money for any library that would be built. One is it only provided a building. It didn't provide books or land or anything like that.
Oh.
So it was helpful if the community already had an established library within it. The city where it was located would have to provide 10% of the total grant award annually for the library, so that would be $5,000. In a year.
So what was Gloversville like when this library was built? And what's Gloversville like now?
The original grant was given in 1902 and the library opened in 1905. And this was a time of economic prosperity for Gloversville. It was actually the center of glove making in the world, Fulton County
wow.
in general. A lot of the people who lived in the county were involved in the industry, whether it was working in the tanneries or making the gloves. So it was an economically booming time for the area. There was a lot going on. It was prosperous. People joked that you could quit a job in the morning and have a different job by the afternoon. So there was a lot of opportunity for people at the time. Unfortunately, by the mid-20th century, the industry started to decline. Companies began to move overseas as there became environmental regulations, taxes, things like that, that they didn't necessarily want to have to deal with. And also people stopped wearing gloves. It was not fashionable
right.
to wear them anymore. So we've been in a bit of an economic depression. I think our story is not unlike many upstate industrial towns that have experienced similar things over the past 50 years. But the community is really working to keep it positive and bring events to the area that people will be interested in and continue to grow. It will never be, you know, the glove capital of America, but hopefully something new and different will come in and make the city a great place once again.
Since the economic circumstances have changed so much, what's the library like now?
Well, like anything, any organization, they've dealt with their economic challenges and overcome them. But to me, I've lived there my whole life. They've always been a staple of the community. I got my first library card there when I was 5 years old, and I still go there today. And they offer tons of events. I saw they were doing Spanish classes a couple of weeks ago. They offer programs for children, story time, craft making. They have a book club, a book sale. So they're really trying to serve as a center, I think, for community activity in the area, which is great.
They've been putting on a big fundraising campaign. I know the novelist
yes.
Richard Russo
yes.
has been involved. So when you look around, is, you know, trying to save the library, update it, kind of get it back up to its grandeur. Is that something that you feel like people talk about in Gloversville a lot right now?
Yeah, especially in the local paper. I think because Richard Russo is so involved, it's been a good talking point for people. If it depends on who you ask in Gloversville, if they're a fan of his or not. I'm not sure if you've read any of his novels. I personally love them, but a lot of his novels take place in fictional cities that are pretty much Gloversville in the economic depressed times. And so a lot of people sometimes take issue with that. Other people are big fans. It depends on who you ask. But it's gotten press in the New York Times and other big media outlets. So I think this is a worthwhile cause, and the community certainly appreciates it.
I know they're trying to raise several million dollars, and they just got a check for a million. You think they're going to make it?
Yes. I hope so. It seems they're going along pretty good speed. You certainly don't hope that they don't, but I think they will. I think they'll reach their goal. A lot of what they want to do will improve the library. It will provide handicap access to the second floor, which they currently don't have. And there's a great performance space up there. They want to expand their children's room and create an area for teens. So I think it will be something that's really good once they do reach their goal.
Samantha, are there new industries coming into Gloversville? I looked at the number of vacant housing units. That's higher than the median. You know, it feels like you're telling the story of a place that's not in great economic shape.
That's true. But there are people working to bring new industries to the area. For example, they just brought in they had their first harvest of medicinal marijuana at the Tryon Industrial Park. Yes, in New York State in over, I think it was 90 years or something crazy like that. So they've taken this old abandoned, it was a correctional facility for teenagers, and have turned it into this industrial park. And that's one of the businesses that has gone in there. Over the past couple years, we've had Faye Greek Yogurt come in. So there are the county, Fulton County, is working to provide shovel-ready sites for industries that want to come to Fulton County, and giving them incentives to come with their businesses here. So they're trying. You know, it's never easy, but fingers crossed and, you know, positivity for the future.
Samantha Hall Saladino is the historian for Fulton County, New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Come tell us about the important money stories where you live. Go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Local Money if you have a story idea you want us to explore.
I gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
That is from the amazing movie Office Space, which just happens to capture how weird office life can be. There are all sorts of unwritten rules about how to behave, rules that, for the most part, you only learn from experience, often embarrassing experience. Or you could just read Ross McCammon's book, Works Well with Others. He came in to talk about it, and we decided to do the interview in the middle of our office, where boxes are piled up for our renovation. Thanks, Ross.
Thank you for having me.
I want to dive right into one of the chapters, which is how to make small talk.
Yes.
We have stolen a guinea pig from our staff, Tobin Lowe, who doesn't really know what's coming his way.
That makes two of us.
So. Yeah, good. Hi, random person I pulled in from the office.
How's it going?
Great, great. Weird room.
Yeah, it is kind of a weird room. There's a lot of boxes going on in here.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think these boxes are for?
Oh, man. Definitely illegal stuff.
Why would you say that?
I'm distrustful of any boxes that are stacked and unlabeled, which is a lot is happening here.
That's a good point. And there seem to be boxes stacked in boxes, which is also weird.
A little Ouroboros of boxes happening, I feel.
Exactly.
You both look really awkward.
But I have an observation, though.
Okay, go.
He did something. He took it from small talk to medium talk because he sort of said, I am distrustful of. And so all of a sudden, his take on the boxes became some reflection on him. And that is generous, telling me something about you. And now all of a sudden, we're in medium talk, which is, you know, a lot better.
What is medium talk?
Well, medium talk is observations and not reports, basically. That's the idea. It's and which is inherently more personal.
All right, you did well. Get out of here. Awkwardness runs throughout this entire book. I would say awkwardness seems to be the theme.
Yes.
Are these all things you learned by screwing up?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's actually a chapter in the book where I basically endorse screwing up. It's ways in which you must screw up early on. There's a handy checklist. And
what are the ways in which you must screw up?
Well, I think it changes for everybody. For me, I mean, the first thing I did as an employee at Esquire was I went to the men's room, as one does, and I saw what I assumed was a fellow employee there, and I said, "Hi, I'm Ross." And I went out to, I reached out to shake his hand. And at that moment, we both looked at each other and thought, is this really happening? there's a rule, there's an unwritten rule in the workplace, and that's you don't shake hands in the restroom. So that was my first official social act, and that was a screw up. And I no longer cringe about it, but I did cringe about it. But now, but there are other things that we do. I think there's, you know, we screw up at our jobs, and I think that's another thing that we should allow ourselves to do, because if you're not screwing up early on, I think you're probably overqualified.
I like that chapter. There's another one that I'm particularly fond of, which is how to drink with your boss.
Yeah. The first rule of drinking with your boss is don't drink more than your boss.
So how do I do that? Like, we wander into the bar, the party, you know, office holiday party is coming up. That's just a landmine many people.
It's
how do I navigate that?
Yeah. But what's weird about the holiday party is that you have to look at it as it's still the office, you know, and it's not like the rules of office politics don't apply in that situation. So I think the first thing to do when you go in there is you say hi to the boss, because what you want to do, what you want to have the option of, is leaving whenever you want to. And that's the key. You know, don't drink too much, but also leave before you think you want to. And when you leave, just leave.
There is a name for this, and I feel like since your last name is McCammon and mine is O'Leary, we can call it.
Yeah, it's the Irish exit, the Irish goodbye, which is really odd, because Irish people love to say goodbye. So my take is that the Irish exit is a way to avoid the Irish goodbye.
A lot of this takes me back to one of my first office jobs when I was, I don't know, 23, 24, and I made so many of these mistakes, and they still mortify me thinking about them. Why doesn't anyone ever tell us how to act in an office?
Well, I think we forget, you know, once we become comfortable in an office, I think we forget how difficult it is for, you know, I'll see sometimes interns at the magazine. And you really have to empathize, and that takes a little bit of effort, because you just have to remember, this is a very, very strange place for them. They don't know what the rules are. And the first day can seem so, so difficult. And so
long.
It's so long. But what you have to understand is that it doesn't matter. It's just a rite of passage the first day. And I think the tip is almost, don't worry about it. You know, it all starts over on the second day.
You have a lot of things in this book that are written in a comical, brash style, but have more serious undercurrents in them. I'm thinking about how to be in a meeting where the tips are essentially shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up.
Right.
Speak quickly.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I'm happy to hear you describe the book that way, because part of this book is a sort of satire in a way. But I think I can't help it, because the workplace is so bizarre and so awkward, you know. And we spend time with these people who we didn't normally choose to spend time with. And we spend sometimes more time with them than our families. But these relationships are incredibly important. And to the extent that there is anxiety related to, you know, some of these awkward situations, and to the extent that you're still cringing about a situation 8 years later, that is serious. You know, I think that stuff is actually really serious, because I think it can get in the way of you doing your best job and also having meaningful relationships with people.
Ross McCammon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We're going to stay with that workplace thing now, and certain people at the top. Our Marketplace colleague, Sabri Benishore, is here to explain. Welcome back.
Thanks.
You did an incredible story about a workplace archetype that I think most people are relatively familiar with. I'll put it in a sanitized version, the jerk boss.
Yep. That is, I wanted to look into why are so many bosses jerks? I mean, it can't just be our imagination. And that's how I started off, by asking people. And you know what? As I assumed, I heard a lot of jerk boss stories.
She would definitely get upset and yell and scream.
Texted people 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning.
And put me and my colleagues down.
And if you didn't respond within half an hour, you would be given a warning.
I mean, yes, I
don't consider him a good person.
Most of these people didn't want to be identified because their bosses are jerks, among other reasons. Now, this jerk boss problem is not some kind of accident. At least a lot of researchers don't think so. It may not come as a total surprise, but there's a lot of research that suggests being a jerk can actually help you become a boss. Not a good boss, but a boss.
If you look at these traits, such as being Machiavellian, narcissistic, you will find that most of these traits tend to have short-term advantages.
Dr. Tomas Chamorro-Primusic is CEO of Hogan Assessments. It's a consulting firm that helps companies develop talent.
Some of these attributes help people get to position of power and navigate their careers upwards, but at the same time, they don't really contribute to leadership effectiveness or management effectiveness, which is why you find so many bosses that are assholes.
It's not that hard to understand how this works. Take narcissists, people who are super egocentric and usually insecure at the same time.
Let's just take a door-to-door salesperson.
Murray Barrick is head of the Center for Human Resource Management at Texas A&M.
You know, door-to-door salespeople get rejected all the time, but a narcissistic door-to-door salesperson actually can handle that rejection much better, because a narcissistic salesperson would say, you're not rejecting me because of me, you're rejecting me because you're dumb or something.
Same thing for entrepreneurs and corporate leaders. Being narcissistic, or in some cases a sociopath, can be helpful in interviews too.
When you first meet a narcissist, they tend to make a positive impression on you.
Emily Grijalva is assistant professor at the University at Buffalo School of Management. She did a meta-analysis of 18 studies with 30,000 test subjects and found narcissism increases your chances of becoming a leader.
So if you were to meet someone narcissistic at a party, you'd probably think they were really entertaining and attractive.
She says narcissists tend to be better dressed, have better posture, and be charming. Some sociopaths can do this too.
They're going to portray themselves as being a leader.
These people believe that they're good.
Jeannie Brantover is a managing partner at Boyden Global Executive Search. She described her former boss earlier. She says confidence does not equal competence.
These people aren't, they're not really imposters, you know. When I interview people, they really believe in themselves, you know, whether someone is, you know, an egomaniac, just not a good person. You know, they truly have bought into whoever they are.
Now, here's where it's not totally the narcissist or the sociopath or the jerk's fault. Part of the problem, many researchers argue, is that we think wrongly that jerks make good leaders. So even if we have an inkling that someone is a boorish, maniacal brute, we're somehow drawn in.
Showing that kind of asshole behavior matches up to this bad idea that is embraced in the business world that the most effective leader is the hard-nosed driver.
Fred Keel is the author of The Return on Character and founder of KRW International. They help develop leadership inside companies.
So they're a little rough on people. At least they're taking action.
Tomas Chamorro-Primusic says that because of this jerk effect, bosses are actually more likely to fail.
There's a lot of data on this. In general, bosses perform pretty poorly. If you look at large corporations in the past 5 years, on average, they have all fired around 15 to 20% of senior leaders, so C-suites, you know, CEO, COO, and so forth.
The sad thing about jerk bosses, and this is actually one of the things that can do them in the end, is that they don't really take cues or criticism. In fact, if you are a jerk, narcissistic boss listening to this story, you're probably going to think it's about your boss, when actually, it's about you.
I listened to this story with a little bit of dread, but also a lot of recognition, Sabri. What did you hear from people after this ran?
Oh, my God. It was like such an outpouring. Like, this was spot on. Like, oh, my God. Did you talk to my boss for this story? This makes total sense. And you know what? It does. And it, in my opinion, it boils down just so well to that little phrase that one of my interviews used. Confidence does not equal competence. You know, that's what it comes down to. But we love confidence. We love it. And we put so much faith in it that we select these people.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishore, thank you.
You're welcome.
Every so often on this show, we talk to sports expert Lee Eagle. And this week, we're focused on security. In part because one of the attacks in Paris played out near the Stade de France stadium during a soccer match between France and Germany. Eagle is the co-director of NYU's Sports and Society program. We brought him in to talk about the security operations for teams and leagues. Hi, Lee.
Hi, always good to be here.
When you think about those kinds of operations and how big they are, something like the NFL, what kind of cost are we talking about?
We're getting into the millions and millions of dollars for each event. There's logistics, there's planning, there's not only inside the facility, but on the exterior and the plazas around it, and then you've got streets, surrounding streets, and there's real attention to the ways in and ways out. So in France, they probably had a pretty good idea. I don't think that they just got lucky. And some of the people I've spoken to who are in law enforcement at that level and in sports don't really think so either. They think there's a pretty good chance they knew what they were doing.
One of the criticisms that certainly has come toward airport screening security is that some of this is security theater, that it's hard to know what is truly effective and what appears effective because there's some big burly person standing there. Does that hold true in sports too?
It does. It does hold true in sports that there's somebody big and burly. We think it's sort of the bouncer at the bar,
right?
Would be the one who is. But really, there is so much more going on, and there's so much.
Tell me a little bit about what's
appear.
Going on.
Well, I think that one thing that's always stuck out to me is that there are all these people in the stands with yellow jackets on, and it says something like event staff or security, and you know, in facilities and in the really, really secure ones, those are people who are trained. Huh. And I can tell you for sure in the professional sports leagues here, there's a lot that goes into their training and development.
We saw France and Germany continue to play in that soccer game. If you are the head of a team, what do you do in a situation like that? You know, how careful do you have to be in terms of the image that you project to the world?
There is so much that goes into not only the image, but really, in this case, the reality of it also.
True.
In 1989, there was an earthquake, the Major League Baseball World Series.
Absolutely.
In San Francisco.
Candlestick Park.
At Candlestick Park. Kevin Hallinan, who was then the director of security and facilities at Major League Baseball, was, of course, there. And a credit to him tells the story of the decision-making that went on in the moment about whether or not to keep people in the ballpark. And ultimately, they decided to keep people in the ballpark, and it was coordination between Major League Baseball, the commissioner, who was there, of course, as well, Major League Baseball security, and then local law enforcement, including sending around a police car onto the field with a bullhorn because the public address system had been knocked out.
Right.
So these are spur-of-the-moment, you know, live action decision making.
And why did they decide to keep people in?
They decided to keep people in the ballpark because they knew that it had withstood the earthquake. And they didn't know at the time, in the moment, what was going on outside. And knowing that people were safe and secure in that facility was really a turning point in the decision making. And there's a really good parallel, unfortunately, but a really good parallel to Paris, where they knew, at least as far as they could tell, the stadium was secure and they could keep people there, and it prevented people from running out into Paris where God only knows what was going on.
Lee Eagle is the co-director of NYU Sports and Society. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And that's our show. Next week, we'll be hearing some of our favorite stories about money and life. And in the meantime, we want to know, do you get paid enough for what you actually do? And if not, what's standing in your way? Let us know by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan, with help this week from Gina Delbach. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer, and Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.